I'm in full daylight mode today. Something very different, partly in full daylight mode because I needed to see as I pulled all of this crap apart under my desk trying to make the bloody sound work. So not just the sound, I'm trying to make the sound work and the camera work. I think both of them now work. So for the folks who are online here, I'm sure someone will tell me if my lips are moving and no noise is coming out. So I'm still struggling with this DAC, this digital analog converter for the audio, where when I've got that plugged in and I try to choose it as an audio source because the mic runs through under there, then the camera doesn't want to work, but only doesn't want to work in Chrome. And Universal, who makes the equipment, doesn't really know what's wrong. Like, they've had lots of suggestions. Have you tried restarting it? Have you updated all your firmware and all your BIOS and all your USB drivers? It's like, yes. So all of that is up to speed. And then they're like, all right, we'll give us go through to your sysinfo stuff and send us all that, and we'll have a look at it. All right, maybe something will come out of that. But out of desperation, I thought, well, I will try it on the laptop as well, because there's this question about, is it USB? Is it just like two high-speed USB 3 devices having trouble with bandwidth? So I've put the Apollo Twin DAC into the laptop and then just used the built-in webcam. So no USB dependency. I assume that just goes straight to the board somewhere. Same thing. So same problem. At the moment, this DAC just doesn't want to do audio in and also do video from any video device on either of the two Windows PCs I've tried. So I'm basically at the point of losing my shit over this, and it's sort of like, am I going to end up with two different audio devices? Because I've already, see, maybe this is where I am. Maybe I just keep the Apollo Twin DAC to drive the sound system, which sounds epic, and then I have to keep the old Yamaha just to drive the mic. At least I already got the equipment. But anyway, it's just infuriating because this sort of shit just should not happen. Anyway, that off my chest. Lots of noise. So I just looked at the comments and I saw Ali saying, I do not hear any noise. And then I was like, oh, shit. And then he says, audio is okay. And other people say audio is okay. So thank you. I just... You know, sometimes you get stuck on problems where you're spending your whole time just trying to make stuff work and not actually producing anything. So I've spent a huge amount of time in recent days trying to make this work properly. And then I was trying to make even like the Lenovo update service on my PC work properly. That had problems as well. I've been trying to make the fingerprint reader on my laptop work properly. That is now suddenly really, really flaky, and I have to keep entering either the password or the PIN, neither of which I can remember. 3D printer wasn't working properly because the Z-axis just wasn't quite right, and then I had some bed adhesion problems. Bits of the IoT network are not working right because one of the little motion sensors, like this guy here, just outside our master bedroom, is meant to turn a light on, just stopped working, and I changed the battery. It still doesn't work. And it's just a series of other things. Oh, the weather station. Weather station's fine, but Weather Underground doesn't work anymore in Home Assistant. So... it's just like a death spiral of fixing stuff and not getting things done. Ali says, happy April 1st. That was yesterday. I'll come back to things that felt like they were April 1st jokes. Stefan says, fingerprint and sound config, the main reasons I switched back to Mac OS from Ubuntu. Well, neither of those are my problem at the moment. We've had different problems with Charlotte's Mac, but there's a tweet thread on that too. Anyway, let me move on to things because there are things happening. The first thing is I got a brand new sponsor this week, which is Hack from the masterminds behind Black Hat, taking place in Saudi Arabia 2021. Now, I have never been to Saudi Arabia, and I would have liked to have been able to go to Hack. Now, this is at Hack as well. Would have liked to have been able to go to at Hack if I was able to travel to Saudi Arabia. I think it would be a fascinating place. The only spot in the Middle East I've been to is Israel a couple of years ago, and that was fascinating, very different to everywhere else I've been. So at Hack is running from the 20th to the 30th of November 2021 in the Riyadh Front Expo Center, Saudi Arabia. And now I hope that they are actually able to run that event and the craziness of the world doesn't put that at risk. And they're running it in association with Black Hat as well. So if you are in Saudi Arabia or you can get to Saudi Arabia, that sounds like it would be a really neat event. And they've actually got some epic graphics on this website as well. So just follow the link at the top of my blog and have a look. This looks really, really cool. That would be a nice event to go to. Maybe at Hack 2022 will be my year. Anyway, on to other things. Now, I'm going to start with a tweet about password managers and some of the ensuing discussion. Now, I try not to get into debates about other password managers simply because of my role with 1Password. So I'm on 1Password's advisory board. I get some money for that. I still buy my own 1Password, which is what's going to lead me through to this tweet. In fact, I don't even know if maybe they would have given me one if I had have asked, but obviously I just had my credit card in there and it charged it, and it was only like $60, which I reckon is bloody good value, and I'm going to talk about that in a moment. But the bit about not commenting on other password managers, I don't want to sort of be in a, now that I'm incentivized and much closer to the company, I don't want it to seem like I'm saying that I don't like what these other ones do or something like that. So what I'm going to do instead is talk about what I tweeted and two themes that came through in the responses. So I tweeted my invoice the other day. So I paid $59.85 for the family's annual plan. And like I said, obviously my credit card was just still in the system. They charged me. It's fine. Actually, I paid $59.85 plus tax, 10% tax. So I paid $65.84. So the thing is, that's 12 months. So what does that make it? About $5 and a bit per month. And that's for five people too. So Charlotte and I both have accounts on the family account. The kids both have accounts. So we've got four of us using it. We share vaults between each other. So when we need to share a secret, for example, we share that via 1Password with the other person. It has not just our passwords in there, but our credit cards and our driver's licenses and that sort of thing, and a whole bunch of secure notes. I've got a whole bunch of things like certificate keys and stuff like that go into 1Password because that's the most secure place I have to store them. Now, I shared this and lots of love for 1Password, which is the first thing. And as I've said many times before, I had a lot of love for 1Password well and truly before they gave me a cent. So that was a very, very nice relationship to establish. Now, here's the two things that kept coming up. And one of them was about cloud and one of them was about open source. Actually, the three things. One of them was about money. So let's do the money one first. A bunch of people say, yeah, always, I'm trying to pick the right words here. Basically saying you don't need to pay, you can get it for free. Or other people saying that the cost was a barrier. And I just, so what does that come down to? It comes down to $5 something a month. And I don't want to say this in a way that sounds obnoxious and privileged, but $5 a month for the thing that has the secrets that control your digital life, it seems almost everywhere, it seems very reasonable. I think almost everywhere it is, if I put it by the latte meter, it's about 1.5 lattes per month. Latte. So 1.5 lattes per month for your entire family to have a password manager and securely share secrets. It's just, if that cost is genuinely a barrier, totally understand. If you're just making the point that you don't need to spend money on it and you're going out and buying a latte every day, it's not a very, very good position to take. So the cost is obviously positioned at that point to be extremely effective. The other thing is, and I'm going to get my terminology right here. All right. A few little tweets here made this point. They said, also worth mentioning, if you do a business/teams account, every member of the team gets a free family account. This is something I've really liked about their attitude towards security. And this is not just a one password thing. I think it's more just the view of security, which is there is, if you're going to have like a business or a Teams account or something like that, that is a totally independent account to whatever it is that you have at home. Nothing is connected technically in any way. The thing that is connected between the business account and the home account is the person. And 1Password's position was, things like password management are habits that people take with them between the office and the home. If we can improve their habits at home, it will also improve their habits at work and vice versa. So wouldn't it be cool to say if you have a business level account, you also get a home account, and then each one kind of makes the other one better. Isn't that nice? It's like we get to a better position here of overall security posture. So you might be able to get it for free if it is used by your enterprise. All right, so there's the cost thing. Now, the two other things. So one of them was about cloud. And even just before I came into this, started doing this live stream, I was seeing comments in my Twitter thread about cloud. And there is a view that you should never put anything in cloud when it comes to a password manager. Now, let's talk about it in both a security posture position and a usability posture position, because as I've discussed many, many times before, so many things, these two things work very, very closely together. If you make passwords too hard for people, there's the UX problem, then your security will suffer. Things like extended validation certificates never worked because whilst that might offer some identity verification because the UX is terrible and no one understands it, it doesn't work. So all of these things are always very intermingled. So with the cloud bit, you must have a mechanism, number one, of backing up your keychain. Now, of course, there are ways of doing this manually if you're not using a cloud sync service. Before 1Password had their cloud service, we used to drop the keychains in Dropbox and the Dropbox would sync the keychain. So you've got to have a way of backing the thing up. You've got to have a way for most of us in the modern day of syncing it. And I'm just looking around me. I've got my iPhone here, my PC there, my laptop there, my iPad over there. I think I probably have some other devices somewhere else, but I want to know that when I'm out there at the coffee shop and I've just decided to sign up to a website because I have to sign up in order to buy the thing that I was just trying to buy while I was standing in the queue, when I come home and I want to check the order status, I can log onto my laptop and see it. So syncing between devices is very important. So you need something to do that. And yeah, I was just about to say you could do it with a floppy disk. You could, but probably not with this. You could do it like with a USB key between PCs. And I've heard people say they do this. Honestly, like, are you going to actually do that reliably and consistently? It sounds like a real pain in the ass. Now, maybe if your threat model is so bad that you think that something terrible is going to happen if anything goes in the cloud, I kind of get that, but it just seems like a lot of hard work. And then, of course, when you get to the families bit, the only way you're going to be able to share something with other family members in any reasonable, feasible, usable way is you're going to have to have an online service to sync the stuff. Now, if I want to say to Charlotte, you know, look, let's say the online shopping account to get the groceries, look, I've just changed the password. I would like you to have the new password. It's like, well, it's in our shared vault. So it's easy. She has access to that immediately. So that's a very important thing. Now, for some people, they see a lot of risk there, and I question severely how much risk there is. The person who made the comment just before was like, well, what if like the entire 1Password infrastructure gets owned? Well, everything is encrypted on your device. Like, it is literally encrypted here before it goes to the cloud. So not only is it resilient to all of 1Password's infrastructure being owned, but it's also resilient to 1Password going rogue and saying, we're now going to go and look at everybody's passwords because they just can't do that. So there's that bit. Now, then people will say, okay, well, but 1Password could push down a malicious update. They could modify, and maybe it's not 1Password. Maybe someone goes all SolarWinds on them, right, and modifies the code in the build environment so it pushes down and then no longer encrypts it and then syncs it back up to the cloud and it's not and you're like, well, first of all, if someone's got the position to start running whatever arbitrary code they want on your device, you're kind of stuffed anyway, right? Like, you're screwed to a very large extent, at least as far as it goes with this service in particular. Things like iOS devices do a great job of sandboxing apps. But if you're getting to the position where you're saying that your software could be backdoored, well, whether there's cloud or no cloud, you're going to have problems. And then you sort of get to the point of going, well, if you're getting backdoored on the device, all right, well, maybe you just don't take updates. But if you don't take updates, what happens when there are vulnerabilities or feature enhancements or things like this? And now you're back into the cycle of we're tossing up between taking updates and getting fixes for things, but possibly taking an update and getting something bad. And if we go back to SolarWinds again, it's like, okay, well, people took some updates which had Trojaned backdoors in them and they took that, but then they took another update which removed it. So you see, you're already going in this crazy, crazy cycle. And I think the expectation, the very reasonable expectation we all have, is that when you use a product like 1Password or the gazillion other things I have on my device, that I'm going to get regular updates and they're not going to be backdoored and they're going to be fixed. And if something goes wrong, then they'll fix that and they'll push out a new one. And if you want to sort of move completely away from that model, you're going down a very, very, very different path. So there's that. Now, then there is the bit about open source. And I find this one really interesting. Now, first of all, I use a lot of open source stuff, and I love the idea of open source. Microsoft, remember, I don't work for Microsoft. Microsoft is now the world's largest single contributor to open source based on commit numbers. I think those figures were out quite some time ago, actually. They're very supportive of open source. The whole open source thing is great, and there are lots of very, very good things about it. But what I don't like is the assertion that just because something is open source, it shall be more secure than the thing that is closed source. And of course, 1Password is closed source. Many password managers are closed source. There are open source alternatives. And people be like, well, if I can't read the source code myself, how do I know it's going to be secure? It's like, how much time do you have in your life? Like, are you just sitting around reading source code of password managers and you have nothing better to do with your life? Come and fix my bloody DAC if you've got all that time. Tell you what. I don't like that assertion. I think that's a little bit crazy. The other thing is, of course, you're assuming that you're in a position to actually identify the vulnerabilities and you're smarter than the people who wrote the code, which in some cases may be true. But of course, people say, well, look, it's not just me. Like, there's a community out there. There'll be a community of peer review and they'll all look at the software and it will all be fine because there'll be lots of people checking it, just like OpenSSL. Oh, yeah, that didn't work with OpenSSL, did it? Software is software. Like, you're going to have bugs in open source stuff. You're going to have bugs in proprietary stuff. And you got to look at where there are the strengths and the weaknesses. And arguably, there is a strength in open source because you get to have a bunch of people look at it if they choose to do so. No one is compelled to do so. The proprietary stuff, you know, one of the things that 1Password does very well is they have really extensive auditing over their software. They make sure that there are independent experts that come in, go through the whole thing and identify any vulnerabilities that might be there. And they have a very attractive bug bounty as well. So there's very formal review and there's all of this, you know, look, just go your hardest externally. And off the top of my head, I think the bug bounty for Keychain Takeover was something like $100,000. Don't quote me on that, but you can go and have a look for 1Password bug bounty. So there's a large amount of incentive for people to find vulnerabilities and report them in the responsible fashion. Now, I'm not saying that this makes one better than the other or the other one worse or anything else like this. But my point is, it's not as simple as saying, look, this is open source, therefore it is fine. This other thing is not, therefore it is not fine. I think that's a very, very simplistic view. Okay, so got that off my chest. You're going to have a look at some of the comments over here. And again, look, I'm not going to talk about individual products, but I'm going to mention things that people report here in the comments. KeePass, a lot of people use KeePass. A lot of people use Dashlane. A lot of people use LastPass, not as many anymore, but we won't get into that. The leap from free to not free is the hardest one. Even mobile apps that charge as little as 99 cents can prove a barrier to people. Now, I agree with this. This is from Dr. Blue. As soon as you have to spend any money on something, even if it is like literally measured in cents, there is a mental barrier to get over. I guess my point here is that if it's Candy Crush or equivalent, I don't know what the kids play these days, I understand that. If it is something to protect your digital life and your security, I just think you've got to get over that mental barrier because that is a massive, massive problem. If you cannot get over that mental barrier and the thing that you're focusing on is how many cents per month are you paying rather than what am I doing for my security posture, that's a problem. It's going to keep me well employed, put it that way. Okay, what else we got in here? Opinions in Texas, I had some angst around paying for it from using the free LastPass. I've been happy with the switch and security in 1Password, though. The other thing worth mentioning, now, get your own accounting advice on this, but certainly for me here, because I have income from things to do with tech, that $65 a year or something is paid with pre-tax dollars as well, which actually brings the cost out of my pocket down to probably actually more like the cost of a latte each month rather than a latte and a half each month. This is speaking of tax. I've heard YouTube is now actively detecting views via VPNs to apply full 30% tax on monetization. I'm happy I don't monetize YouTube. It just makes life so much easier. Michelangelo Van Damme says RSS strengths and weaknesses, which is very, very true. And I think what's, I've said so many times that you get people that have extreme views at one end of the scale or the other. You know, OSS is the only way. Don't monetize the software. Software wants to be free. You ever heard that saying? What a crock of shit that is. Well, data wants to be, it doesn't want to be anything. It's not a sentient being. It just like sits there in ones and zeros. And then you get the people on the other end of the scale saying, look, unless it's proprietary and we know that there's been money invested into it and there's going to be support, then that's the only thing that'll be good. Like, both of these extremes are always terrible, and the truth is always, always somewhere in the middle. PHP supply chain attack was the latest in the averted time. I have heard about that one, but I don't have much detail on it. Look, I think, I know the 1Password folks are very supportive of this as well. Like, the number one thing is to use a password manager. It's kind of like no password manager, you're all the way down the bottom of the security line graph, like down here somewhere. Using a password manager, any of the major ones, then suddenly you've leapt to here. And then the only discussion is there's different nuances between them, what makes one better than the other, but you're still so far ahead of the other end of the scale from the people who don't have one. That isn't it nice to be arguing about the little nuances here as opposed to arguing about whether you should have one or not? Okay. Next thing. Ubiquity. I loved it so much. All right, let's talk about Ubiquity. And it's funny because I had multiple people sort of tweet me and they're like, oh, I notice you're not talking about the Ubiquity breach. And obviously they're trying to make the insinuation that because Ubiquity has given me a bunch of stuff over the years, that it's not something I'm going to talk about. Nah, wrong. I'm going to talk about it anyway because it needs talking about. And also, it was quite funny that the people were tweeting me about this like hours and hours and hours after I'd already started the tweet thread saying how unimpressed I was with this. So let's talk about what happened. It was Jan 12 when a data breach notification from Ubiquity went out. Now, people started bringing this to my attention. Inevitably, when you have to send a lot of emails, they get to some people before they get to others. And I did eventually get an email about their incident, but only after other people sent it to me first. And when I first saw it, I was like, is this even real? Like, there was a typo in the first sentence. I did talk about it on this video back in January as well. Typo in the first sentence, very little information, felt very vague. It just, I literally had to go to my Ubiquity contact and say, is this real? Because it feels like someone has made this up. Anyway, it was real. So I gave them some very candid feedback. And I said, look, this breach notification is just terrible. Like, there's very little transparency. Okay, there's really no transparency. It doesn't tell us what happened. It doesn't give us any idea of the technical nuances of how this thing occurred. It really doesn't give us any detail about, for example, all of us who log on via the Ubiquity cloud, which is something they've been pushing a lot. Is there any risk at all to an attacker seeing our internal network, seeing the devices in the network? And that would give them a lot of things that would be very, very unpleasant for many of us. And they just didn't release any further information. And this was January. And the sense I got, without sort of disclosing internal discussions I had with my person there, that the sense that was really clear from the outside is that they just didn't want to share any more information. And that the first notice that went out had been written by lawyers. And look, I know we have to have lawyers, but they're not all terrible. I've spent a lot of time with some very nice lawyers lately. It's another story. Not to do with have I been pwned. So, this was not a good message. And then we got through to a couple of days ago and Krebs does a story. And the Krebs title here is Whistleblower, Ubiquity Breach Catastrophic, in double quotes. Now, that is a very strongly worded headline. And then you read through it and Krebs is talking about back in Jan, they had their incident, they did the disclosure. They're saying a security professional at Ubiquity who helped the company respond to a two-month breach beginning in December 2020 contacted Krebs after raising his concerns with both Ubiquity's whistleblower hotline and with European data protection authorities. The source, we'll call him Adam, spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of retribution by Ubiquity. He's then gone through and said, look, there's a whole bunch of different issues here. It was catastrophically worse than reported, legal silence and overruled efforts to decisively protect customers. He said, what were the other sort of key points here? Attackers obtained full read-write access to Ubiquity database at Amazon Web Services, which was the alleged third party involved in the breach because Ubiquity's initial notice said a breach at a third party provider. And they're sort of, as the quote here says, they downplayed and purposefully written to imply that a third-party cloud vendor was at risk and that Ubiquity was merely a casualty of that instead of the target. So the implication here is that Ubiquiti said a third party when it was actually the AWS service they were sitting on, which is obviously misdirection by lawyers. Now, to be clear, just before we go any further, this is an anonymous source alleging a lot of things. Now, they all seem feasible, which is the reason this has got so much attention, and Krebs does do his research too. So it all sounds very, very feasible, but it is still an anonymous person. Now, there has been some stuff unfold since this story, but when I first saw this, I was like, okay, well, look, this is really going to put Ubiquiti in a position now where they're going to need to respond, because there are claims in here such as the intruders responded by sending a message saying they wanted 50 Bitcoin, which is 2.8 million USD. 50 Bitcoin would be nice, wouldn't it? In exchange for a promise to remain quiet about the breach. So allegedly ransom as well. There was talk in here about backdoors. Ubiquiti did not engage with the hackers. He maintains instead of asking customers to change their password when they next log on, Ubiquiti should have immediately invalidated all of the customers' credentials, and so on and so forth. Ubiquiti had negligent logging, no access logging on database, so it was unable to prove or disprove what they accessed, but the attacker targeted the credentials to the database and created Linux instances with networking connectivity to said databases. And here's the key bit. Legal overrode the repeated request to force rotation of all customer credentials and to revert any device access permission changes within that relevant period. So these are really, really serious claims. And when I first saw this, I thought, all right, well, Ubiquiti is going to have to respond to this. They are going to have to address this. And if it is true, well, then they're going to have to come clean. If it is not true, then they're going to have to put forward their version of events, and at least there will be some public dialogue about it. And I got in touch with my Ubiquiti person again. I said, look, you guys are really going to do better with this. I am happy to get involved in this because I have been involved in many, many, many data breaches and disclosure notices before, and I really like what you guys do, and I want to see you handle this well. The penny that dropped for me several years ago, and it was just before I did the Congress thing, is that data breaches are now so normal. I think that we judge organizations much less on the fact that they have had a data breach and much more on how they handle it. When we think about breaches like Equifax, for example, we go, well, that was just an absolute mess. It was a complete shit show in terms of how they handled it. We think less about the incident. Oh, someone didn't patch Apache Struts, you know, and then that was bad. But then it's like they threw an intern under the bus, and then they blamed it on everything else, and then they took a long time to disclose, and then the way they stood up search services was shitty. Like that's what we think about. We don't think about the breach. We think about the handling of the breach. So it sort of felt to me like Ubiquiti was in a position where, like, you can turn around this ship, which is sort of heading in the wrong direction at the moment. You can bring this back on keel. Like, let's try and craft some better messaging and work on the transparency piece. Anyway, they didn't do that. They instead put out a notice. I'm going to read this here. Now, also, this is like, this must be a few hundred words long. Tops. It's really, really short. As we informed you on January 11, we were the victim of a cybersecurity incident. So like straight away, it's like, it's the other people that are bad. And yes, that's true, but this immediately feels like shifting blame, right? Involved unauthorized access to our IT systems. Given the reporting by Brian Krebs, there is newfound interest and attention in this matter. We would like to provide our community with more information. At the outset, please note that nothing has changed with respect to our analysis of customer data and the security of our products. Anyway, then they go on here. They're not really addressing any of the specific concerns that were raised in the Krebs article. These experts identified no evidence that customer information was accessed or even targeted. Yes, but in the article, it said there were no logs. So if you found no evidence when there were no logs, does that mean that this is... It's an old saying, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. It's like you don't have evidence of an intrusion, but does that just mean that you don't have any evidence at all? And it's not really clear. The attacker who unsuccessfully attempted to extort the company by threatening to release stolen code and specific IT credentials. Now, this is sort of, I'm pretty sure this is the first time they sort of acknowledged that there was ransom involved as well. I don't think the first notice disclosed that. Never claimed to have accessed any customer information. This, along with other evidence, is why we believe that customer data was not the target of or otherwise accessed in connection with the incident. Anyway, then they sort of go on here, and the bit here that was particularly frustrating is they say, as we are cooperating with law enforcement in an ongoing investigation, we cannot comment further. Now, this was nearly 3 months ago that that original announcement went out. And they're saying, look, several months later, we still can't actually give you any information because ongoing investigation. And I'm going to air quote that. Ongoing investigation is often a very convenient way of saying we just don't want to share any more information. Now, what makes it interesting is Ubiquiti is a publicly listed company and their share price has gone up about 50% this year. Because they're a publicly listed company, they are beholden to their shareholders to disclose information that may have a material impact. So, what's happened next? Yahoo Finance, shareholder alert, Ubiquiti Inc. investigated for possible securities laws violations by Block and Leviton LLP. Investors should contact the firm. And then it goes on here to say, where are we? On March 30, 2021, well-known cybersecurity analyst Brian Krebs reported that a source who participated in the response to the breach is alleging Ubiquiti massively downplayed a catastrophic incident to minimize the hit to its stock price and that the third-party cloud provider claim was a fabrication. This anonymous security professional stated that the breach was catastrophically worse than reported and legal silence and overruled efforts to decisively protect customers. The breach was massive. Customer data was at risk. Access to customers' devices deployed in corporations and homes around the world was at risk. On this news, shares are down significantly in intraday trading. So I guess the positive side out of this, if I can search for a positive side, is that due to their public nature, they will have to respond to this. And it's going to be very, very interesting. I'd love to be a fly on the wall, wouldn't you? Love to hear what the lawyers are talking about at the moment. But they're going to have to come out with more information. They're going to have to particularly respond to this investigation. So this will be really, really interesting to see. So, and I'm going to read comments tonight because I can see a bunch of them coming through. But I guess then there's the question of, well, where does this leave me? And I've been speaking to other people who some of you know as well that have received things from Ubiquiti and have been very glowing about Ubiquiti. And honestly, we're all having the discussion about where we stand on this because I don't want to have a situation where I'm getting something from a company for free and talking about it because I loved the gear anyway and they're continuing to behave in this fashion. So honestly, I'm on the fence right now about what to do with this. I certainly don't feel like ripping all the stuff out of my home. I don't think it's that level of problem. And also, if you rip it out, what else do you put in? Someone made the comment in the thread the other day. They're like, all right, well, what's the alternative? Do you just go and get all like Mirakai stuff? And then, okay, is Cisco actually really going to be any better? So there's the question of, you're keeping the gear, but I don't think that's up for discussion at the moment. But the bigger question is, do you want to have the association and do you want to have, continue to receive things from them whilst the organization is responding in this fashion? I would still like to think that they see some common sense or see some sense in this and go, okay, look, let's try and get with the times and start communicating properly about this. Time will tell. I don't know. My offer still stands and I have given extremely candid feedback about how I feel about it all. All right, I'm going to look at some of the comments up here. Ali says MicroTrick should sponsor you. We'll come back to MicroTrick in a moment. Andy, could this be a whistleblower trying to get financial gain? Ubiquiti was heavily short-sold. So I haven't heard anything about short-selling. That would be really, really interesting because if we get to insider trading as well, then there are really, really serious ramifications for that, like jail ramifications. And the thing is, in terms of having an anonymous whistleblower, the concern I have, I totally understand why the person would want to be anonymous as well, but the concern, of course, is how trustworthy is this individual? Now, I will come back to Ubiquiti, but tangential note, last night I shared a tweet thread. If you've got kids in the car and you listen to this, now's the time to cover their ears. So Pentest Partners in the UK, run by a mate of mine, Ken Munro, late last year did a story on the male chastity lock. the Bluetooth-enabled male chastity lock and how it could be remotely controlled by attackers. And then we get through to, I think it was January sometime, and Lorenzo from Vice Magazine did a story on how a guy got his equipment trapped in the chastity lock and ransomed by a hacker and then had to get bolt cutters to cut it off. Now, Lorenzo is an absolute top-notch InfoSec journalist. We've done many stories together, and I've got a lot of respect for the guy. So he would have done some research on this. But anyway, it turns out that that this was an Aussie comedian who fabricated the story, and he managed to trick Lorenzo into believing it was real after creating a whole bunch of online fake profiles and obviously meeting the bar required for Lorenzo to then go and publish the story. And I guess I just immediately thought of that when I read this bit, this comment from, actually it was from Andy just here, that we have had instances before where people have fabricated InfoSec stories. And the fact that I was tweeting about it only like 12 hours ago, I think is kind of interesting. Now, whether or not that's the case here, we don't yet know. And this is why the onus is on Ubiquiti to respond. When there are claims like there's no third-party provider and there's no logging, they should be, forget this bloody ongoing investigation bullshit, like find something in there where they can come out and either confirm or deny the claims. Of course, the problem is that if the guy is right and they confirm it, what does that mean in terms of SEC law? You know, like that is really, really, that's beyond like reputation damage. That's like CEOs being charged kind of thing. Look at the other comments. I love Ubiquiti so much. We're going to use quite a bunch of stuff in new office, but I guess that won't stop us from doing it. And there's another whole discussion here about, after a security incident occurs with an organization, does that make them better or worse than before the incident occurred? So their handling and culture of the place aside, and that has obviously been very, very poor. Do we trust Ubiquiti equipment less today than what we did, let's say, in December? Now, on the one hand, you could say, well, we have a better idea as to how the organization handles things like this. Therefore, how can we expect them to respond properly when something bad happens? On the other hand, very often these incidents do significantly strengthen the security posture of an organization. And if I had to pick one example off the top of my head, the Australian Red Cross Blood Service, who had a massive breach in 2017, I think it was. And I had some insight into what happened internally there, and stuff got much, much, much better afterwards. So you're sort of going, all right, well, we're seeing a corporate culture we don't like, but also as a result of this, inevitably a bunch of stuff would have improved. All right, I'm going to read the Ubiquiti-based comments here. Anonymous short seller could have made tens of millions of dollars. I've often, right, here's an interesting thing, and this came up in a talk I was doing this week, but people often say that data breaches don't have any impact on share price, because if you look at all these different organizations that are publicly listed and have had breaches before, and they've still just kept going up and up and up and up. However, what's really interesting, and you can see this in so many different breaches, is the, literally as the term was here, the intraday trading. So the trading that happens in very short increments after, or very short time periods after notifications happen. And when we see shares fell approximately 5.3% over the next two trading days, people playing the game and expecting the shares to fall 5.3% or any small percentage could have made absolute truckloads of money on this. Now, I don't know how to short sell. If you do, get in touch. No. But there have been many, many occasions where I have known about something that's going to come for a publicly listed company, and then it comes, and then you see that, like, it's a little dip and then it keeps going. But that little dip, some people, per the comment here, are making large amounts of money in that. Here's Lars. So Lars is one of the people that I have been discussing about Ubiquiti things with, because Lars, as he has said publicly many times before, has got a lot of Ubiquiti stuff at his farm. And I think, like me, he would agree that we love the equipment. The person that we deal with there, great guy as well. It's just the way this place is being run that's the concerning thing. OJ, do you have any comment on the policy of some banks? That's not to do with Ubiquiti. I'm going to keep it on there. I really like how Nobu Casa handled Home Assistant security vulnerability, big banner, immediately cut off access for unpatched versions and took community feedback about future notices in HA. That's a good comment from Dale. I guess Nabu Casa weren't trying to protect their share price. I mean, they're just a community project, I think run by a 503c nonprofit. Money changes everything, doesn't it? Andy says it doesn't look pretty, but given that the ransom demanded, relatively speaking, was so tiny, can it really be that bad? I don't know, mate. Maybe like $2.8 million is tiny for you. But for me, I'd be like, wow, that's a lot of money. And I know what you're saying. For Ubiquity as an organization, that is a very, very small amount of money. It's probably like if someone went, buy me a cappuccino or I release all your data. It's like, stuff it, I just buy a cappuccino. Does it really matter? So I get what you're saying. But I guess we're also into this whole sort of ethical position of what does it mean to pay a ransom? Should you ever pay the ransom? You know, does it really just leave you open to further action? And also you get no guarantees that someone won't go and do what they said they wouldn't do if you do pay the ransom. Someone here says for once it wasn't Cisco. And this is the problem, right? When I made the comment about going to, you know, probably Merakai is one of the biggest competitors. It's like, well, they got their problems too. Ramlin Geek says it also damages your reputation. So I think if you're talking about, I'm not sure if you're talking about damages their reputation, it definitely does. Does it damage, say, Lars and my reputation? Well, this is really the discussion that we're having. And it's not just about you're not wanting to damage reputation, but it's like, who do we want to either implicitly or explicitly endorse? Lars says, I've been on a fair few networking forums for non-professionals, spoken to other UBNT users, looked at FB groups, and most aren't aware of this news or don't care. What are my thoughts on that? Well, I think if you're not aware, you haven't been paying attention. And I say that because, first of all, to the best of my knowledge, and I'm sure you got one too, Lars, but everyone got an email who was impacted. I got an email. So I think if you ask the question, what should they do? All right, they probably could have pushed a notification or something through the portal so that when you log onto your dashboard, you'd see that. But my expectation would be everyone should get an email. And we did get an email. It wasn't a very good email, but everyone got an email. So we should be aware. But perhaps the gravity of it wasn't, well, we know the gravity of it wasn't properly explained in the first email. So I think people can't say they weren't aware and not have that seem a little bit shady, if you know what I mean. Brian Krebs is a trustworthy investigative reporter who would check his sources before publishing something. So he does get my benefit of the doubt. Krebs has been wrong before. And to the example of Lorenzo, he's also a very credible InfoSec journalist as well. And he was wrong on that story I mentioned last night. Now, I don't think that just if we play the averages, it's very rare for either of these guys to be wrong. So the likelihood of him being wrong is low, but possible. This is why Ubiquity needs to come out and actually address all the concerns directly rather than just chuck lawyers at the problem. Okay, what else is there? We've got a lot of comments here. We're currently thinking about switching off online access to our cloud key because there might be some API keys outside. Now, I mean, this is a fair comment by Paul where I think what's happening here is we now have people speculating about what the risk might be. And why are they speculating? Well, they're speculating because there's a vacuum of information. And this is the risk that Ubiquity now creates. And when I talk to organizations about their data breach disclosure notices, this is one of the big points. It's like if you do not explain what happened, people will make up their own mind. Reporters will make up their own mind. People like Paul Weber will make up their own mind. And it might be wrong. And then that story will propagate. So one of the things that I try and do with every disclosure that I'm involved in is like, let me connect you to a journalist like Lorenzo or Krebs. Let me connect you to someone so that you can talk to them and you can get your story across. And then that's the narrative you set. Because if you don't set the narrative, other people will set the narrative. And we have things like this. So Paul, I don't know if that's true or not. Like, I don't know if API keys are out there and it's going to be a problem or not. And Ubiquity hasn't said anything to either confirm or deny that. And there's your problem. What else is in here, which is actually relevant? If you decide to get rid of Unify ecosystem, maybe Ubiquity devices could be flashed with OpenWRT. Should I do that in my spare time? It's like this. I'm not going to go down the road And look, I appreciate the comment, Ali, but like I buy equipment and I want to plug it in and I want to use it. Like I really don't want to muck around with reflashing firmware. I don't even want to reflash firmware on my light bulbs because that sounds like a pain in the ass. I can't get my bloody DAC to work at the moment. Like these are the priorities, like just making things in my life work. And my expectation, I think everyone's expectation, is that when you buy a product like Ubiquiti device, it is secure, it's maintained. If something goes wrong, it's handled responsibly. Now, here we are. Let's have a look at what is going on here. Let's do this. Let's just remove someone who's making noise and not getting any value. The worst thing is that there are no real alternatives for UBNT. Good quality local hosting, reasonable pricing. They do really own this market. And it's not just the Unify range that we're talking about here. It's all the Amplify stuff. I've put so many different Unify or Amplify devices in people's homes because it is the best stuff that I've seen. And it's just consistently so well loved by the community. But this is, I think it's this old adage of things like reputation and trust taking years and years to build, and it can just dissolve in a flash. And again, it just feels like we're at this inflection point where they need to decide, do they want to move forward being a loved and trusted brand, as it has been for many of us, or do they want to burn that because lawyers? I guess we'll see soon enough. I got an email in Jan, but the recent comment Troy was reading was only on the forum. How about registering with the unique ID? Tori. All right, let's move on to other stuff. So that's Ubiquiti thing. This is not run its course yet. There's obviously going to be more. I'm going to keep talking about it, and I'm going to keep telling them how I feel as well, and I'm going to keep thinking about how I want to have that relationship with them look in the longer term. CoinHive, this is fun. Oh, so happy about this. So I wrote a blog post yesterday about CoinHive. Now, just as a refresher for those of you that may not remember or may never have heard of CoinHive, you know how a lot of websites have ads, and very often those ads are like in an iframe, they're of substantial size, and then they're flashy and bright and they distract you from the other stuff, and then they load an iframe within an iframe that pulls in a JS file, that writes some CSS, that puts in an image, that pulls in another iframe, and you just go down this like death spot. Honestly, like go to your element inspector on a website with the traditional ad and look at how far down it goes. It's like if you look at the indentation, once it sort of indents all the DOM elements, it just goes off the screen because there's just so much shit that ads put on in that traditional sense. And of course, then there's the whole bandwidth issue because you're sucking down not just a whole bunch of separate requests, but a whole bunch of different content as well, images and rotating crap and all that sort of thing. A bunch of them have been trojaned in the past and have malicious stuff put in them. I had ads on my blog many, many years ago, and at some stage someone popped up and said, hey, look, every time we go to your blog, we're getting redirected to the App Store to buy Clash of Clans because I was embedding, forget the name of it, but it was a developer-centric ad network that then sat on Google Ads, and obviously there was something malicious in one of them. And then, of course, there's the whole tracking thing. It's like, hey, I searched for headphones the other day on Google. Why do I now go to Troy's blog and I'm seeing an ad for headphones? You know, this doesn't feel good. So people hate that shit. So what you should do instead is just put a crypto miner in their browser. And this was the CoinHive value proposition. And this must have seemed like an absolutely awesome idea at the time, because you can put a JavaScript-based crypto miner, which was embedded with a WebAssembly file, so a WASM file. So WASMs are compiled down to pretty much machine code. They run really efficiently, delivered via JavaScript, and run in the browser, and they would mine Monero coin. And the ROI was such that you could mine enough Monero. Apparently Bitcoin just wasn't an effective model for this sort of deployment. You could mine enough Monero to get yourself a little bit of crypto. And what you do as a site operator is you just put CoinHive on your site, and then you could choose how much CPU to use. You could literally dial it up. So users wouldn't see anything in the browser. If they pop open their CPU usage, they'd see that going off the charts. And what that really meant is that in order to monetize your traffic, you were getting people to pay with some of their electricity for you to mine Monero. Now, you being the site operator, of course. I'm not entirely against this, and that in a way it's a little bit innovative, but it's also very shady, and it's something happening without the knowledge of the people who were visiting the website. Now, I think in theory you were meant to tell them and they could opt out of it and things like that, but really, who's going to do that? And the problem then is that every hacker and their dog who could get a piece of script to run on a website wanted to embed CoinHive, because CoinHive was a way of then monetizing their access to the site. And we were just seeing huge amounts of CoinHive appearing on compromised websites. I wrote something in, it was earlier in 2018, about a third-party library called BrowserLoud, which had been compromised. And in this BrowserLoud file, and BrowserLoud was an accessibility service that you embed on your website just by embedding a JavaScript file from their service. So in this ba.js file, someone who'd gotten control of that file had just whacked CoinHive in the top. So now every website that embedded BrowserLoud, and there were thousands of those, very often government websites because they have a higher standard for accessibility. So thousands of websites embedding this, and then thousands of people coming to those sites, and suddenly you have CoinHive running in, I don't know, possibly millions of different browsers, all mining a tiny, tiny, tiny little bit of Monero and sending it back to the owner of the key who would have done their best to remain anonymous. So super shady service from top to bottom. Anyway, then it disappeared and we were happy. It was it 2019? Yeah, 2019, I think it disappeared. So this was a good result. March 2019, it disappeared. Now, apparently, it just no longer made financial sense. Like the work required to mine Monero couldn't justify the return. And it stopped. Now, before that, apparently the company was making an estimated $250,000 a month, $250,000 a month. And that is kind of impressive, right? So it disappeared March 2019. Now, last year, someone contacted me and gave me the CoinHive domain, and several other domains related to CoinHive. And I don't know how much they want to share, so I haven't gone into detail about how it happened. I didn't just register it when it came up for renewal. I didn't steal it. It was legitimate. It was passed on via white hat means, if you like. It's literally just someone saying, look, they own this domain. Would I like to do something useful with it? So I took it. I think it was about May last year. And last year was kind of busy. There was a lot happening in the world. There was a lot happening in my personal life, and I just did not have the time to do anything with it. And then I was doing a workshop only the week before last, and I was talking about CoinHive, and I was suddenly like, yeah, actually, I own that. I still haven't done anything with it. So whilst people were doing one of the exercises in the workshop, I literally just went to Azure, I spun up an app service, I bound the CoinHive domain to it, I 404'd every single request, but I started logging everything. And I found that there were more than 100,000 unique visitors to the site every day, across more than 3 million requests a day. I think it was about 3.6 million a day was the highest I saw, because there are gazillions of websites out there. Gazillions is thousands, by the way. Thousands of websites out there that are still embedding CoinHive. But because the domain was dead and the site was dead, nothing was happening. It wasn't actually loading anything. If you had looked in the developer tools, you would have seen basically the name not resolving to anywhere. And that was it. So I was like, all right, well, what am I going to do with it now? And I thought about it and I spoke to some people. And long story short, I thought, okay, well, what I'll do is when a website tries to embed CoinHive's JavaScript, I will put my JavaScript there instead. Now, this gives me great power. So I could have done just about anything with this, because you can do just about anything with JavaScript. And I now get to run my JavaScript on thousands of sites. What I really want to happen, though, is I want those sites to be fixed. Now, fixed means two things. Number one, get rid of CoinHive. Number two, fix the flaw that allowed someone to get CoinHive on the website in the first place, because the vast majority of sites with CoinHive on them were compromised sites. And I know this because I found a really, really good white paper and then conference talks by a couple of Dutch guys. And in their findings, they reported, I'm trying to find, I've got a screen cap here somewhere. They reported that there are four different vectors. In fact, there's five different vectors, but we'll talk about these four than the other five, by which CoinHive would end up on a website. Now, a number which rounds to pretty much zero was malicious advertisements, which is what I was explaining before when people were going to bloody Clash of Clans on my blog. Around about 15%, and I'm just reading off a bar graph here, so the actual number is not quite clear. Around about 15% were website owner initiated. So only 15% of instances of CoinHive were people actually wanting CoinHive on their sites. And then around 25% were compromised websites. So your website has had a weak admin password, or it's had a vulnerability somewhere which has allowed someone to drop CoinHive on the site. And then about 60% were third-party software compromises, which would be like the browse allowed situation before. So you're embedding something from somewhere else and that gets compromised. Or you're embedding a library from somewhere and it's installed on your site and that library was Trojan further upstream. The fifth one, which isn't on here, and it comes back to the Microtech comment someone made before, is that there were a bunch of routers which were compromised, and the routers were injecting CoinHive into the traffic as it flowed through the router. Now, you can only do that for unencrypted traffic. So you can only do that on HTTP requests. And this, again, is like one of the value propositions of having HTTPS. It's like even if your website is just a static site and does nothing else, someone could still be injecting CoinHive or something even worse into the traffic flow if it's not encrypted. So there are sort of the five different ways. So what my script does is it pops up a little modal, and the modal says this website attempted to run a crypto miner in your browser. Click here for more information, a link through to the blog post which I'd written. So now there's thousands of websites around the world all popping up my message. And there's a little cross, you can click it and it dismisses and it goes away. And if you click a link to it somewhere else on the same website, you see the same message again. I thought about just setting a cookie and then removing the message, or rather only showing it once. If the cookie exists, don't show the message again. And then I went, no, because people are continuously just dismissing security messages and not paying attention to them. This needs to be overt. And someone sort of made the comments like, well, the user experience of this isn't very good. It's like, the user experience of getting your website owned isn't really good either. Like, maybe fix that thing and then this other thing goes away. So I'm actually quite okay with being a little bit more obnoxious about this. And I actually expected to get up this morning. It's about 24 hours since I posted this. I expected to get up this morning and have some angry emails from site owners. But no, no emails yet. So I'm like a little bit disappointed. I was hoping to have some angry emails and then get to have the discussion of, well, why don't you just fix your website? And then this won't happen anymore. So I will be able to get a pretty good sense of when people start fixing this, because I will see the traffic to the CoinHive website start to decrease. So this is the goal, like get that traffic down as far as possible. It will never go down to zero, but I'd like to see it go from more than 100,000 requests a day to a lot less than that. Now, the last thing here is that this code has been open source. I wonder if I've had any more pull requests overnight, actually. So I've made all of this available to whoever would like to go and view it. It's only really just a little bit of JavaScript. And then the other thing that I've put on here is someone has contributed a WASM, a WebAssembly file. Someone else has now left a comment and said, well, that WASM doesn't actually work. So I see I've got another couple of pull requests here. What is this? Fix modal close and scrolling glitches. Allow users to close the modal by pressing the escape key. Oh, that's cool. So I'll take those pull requests. There's a few issues here. WebSockets shards for investigation. What do they want? I'll read that later. Some glitches here. Multilingual messages. Let's keep building this out. Like this is going to have a long tail, and more than 100,000 unique visitors a day is a very large website. This would put it certainly in the top tens of thousands of websites in the world. So, you know, let's use it to do something good. All right, I'm going to read some of the comments over here. All right, Ali, Microtech is the nearest competitor. Okay, well, we just discussed Microtech. So the Microtech thing was interesting. One of the bits of investigation I did as I was preparing this blog post is because I've got the IIS logs, I can look at all the referrers. So where has this CoinHive JS been embedded? And if I get all the referrers, then I can go through and I can crawl the referrers and I can look for the presence of the CoinHive key. And then I can see, does the same key appear on multiple different websites, which gives you a sense of which websites might have been compromised. I said this in the blog post, but one of the things that was really interesting here is that I found a particular key that was on a lot of different websites. It was one of the most popular ones. Every website was HTTP. And when I Googled the key, I found a tweet which went back years and referenced this being a key that was used on compromised Microtech devices. So obviously what's happened here is someone is still using one of these compromised devices, and every single time they go to an HTTP website, this particular CoinHive key is being inserted into the request. So this poor person now, whichever insecure website they browse, they're seeing my model. And I'd just love to be a fly on the wall, you know? I would love to see them like looking at the screen going, what on earth is this? And yes, I know that that's kind of messing up the user experience, but I really hope that they call the IT guy or something like this and go, hey, can you come and have a look at what's happening here? And they work it out, because they're literally using a compromised device that's inspecting and modifying all of their traffic. And I think an invasive model is a reasonable price to pay for that. Okay, what else is in the list here? I wonder if anyone got actual money from the CoinHive thing. Well, the operators of CoinHive did. Transferring to other websites and conversion rates would probably take most of the money gain. It's a good question. I don't know how much money was actually made out of it. But, yeah, I left a comment on my blog post. I was like, you know, if you have suggestions of what I should do with this, please let me know. Also, don't just tell me to run my own crypto miner in it. The thought did cross my mind. Like, if I was a bad guy and I can now run whatever I want on 100,000 websites, you know, or 100,000 unique visitors a day, like, what would I do? Anyway, I'm not going to do that. Andy, why is crypto always involved in criminal activity nowadays? Many, many good reasons. Because it's not difficult to be quite anonymous with it. It's easily transferable. You're not beholden to banks who might want to actually stop fraudulent payments or payment from ill-gotten gains. Also, if you've ever actually used crypto to buy some stuff, it works really, really well. So hackers like stuff that works really, really well too. But look, before that, it was like, you know, Western Union checks or what were the e-gold, all those sorts of things. So that there's always been something, but crypto is just a better model than these other things for today. Tony says CPU usage for mining is probably less than local tabloids with all the adverts. Yeah, but no, simply because, and in fact, if you look at the embedded video in the blog post that the Dutch guys I mentioned have a good talk on this, there's a bit in there that just shows, like, you open this up and your CPU literally goes up to 100, assuming that it's CoinO has been tuned to use as much CPU as possible, which, of course, is what hackers are going to do. So I get what you mean, and it's shitty how much overhead traditional ads use, but, yeah, this is a different thing altogether. Crypto is not here to make you rich. It should make you free. I don't know how it makes you free, but it certainly made some people rich. I'll tell you what, if Ubiquity had it paid, it would have made someone rich. Because legit crypto stories are not juicy and clickbaity. That's a good response from Michelangelo. This is in the days of Let's Encrypt and Cert, but there is no excuse not to have SSL. There are lots of excuses. Stefan, somewhat unrelated. I'm looking for a full-stack dev job in Oz. You're right, that's unrelated. Lars, so I can't mine with CoinHive anymore. Not unless I put a miner on my CoinHive, but I'm not going to do that. Mike Lander says, Let's Encrypt is awesome. Many people use it, but there are devs and ops who don't control their systems 100% having a third party in charge. Well, then get the third party to do it. Like, there's always someone who is in a position to do it. And that's about everything related to the CoinHive bit. So I've been going for just over an hour, and I do like to try and cap it at that. I will share more details on CoinHive next week, and I really hope that I can come back and go, well, actually, there's many things I hope I can come back and do next week. I hope I can come back and say that the CoinHive requests have gone down. I hope I can come back and say Ubiquity have released a full and transparent statement with technical details. we'll have to see about that. That might be a bit of a stretch. And I hope I can come back and say my DAC is now working, all my audio problems are gone as well, but I have a feeling that that's going to be a stretch too. So thank you very much for joining in. I'll come back next week, and I'll come back later in the day next week, later in my day. Cheers, folks.
Thank you.